If one's going to talk about Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, one has to take into account all the extra musical aspects of the piece. That is, how much it is pervasive in our pop culture through events, personalities, and its usage in other media. I probably, as a music student, I probably read about the piece for years, actually, until I actually heard the piece or was able to come across a recording to listen to. I was sort of let down because it didn't live up to the hype necessarily. I was expecting something a lot bigger than it was. I didn't really think it was, you know, particularly sad. And I don't think it was meant to be particularly sad. I mean, maybe it was serious or somber, but through its uses, it was played on the radio at the announcement of FDR's death, and people have used it for many other kinds of quote-unquote, you know, sad events in film. It gets this extra musical association. So now it becomes a sonic semiotic of sorts. I actually saw a spoof of it done on a recent Seinfeld, well, an old Seinfeld that I had seen recently, in which George Costanza's father talked about a time he was cooking in the Korean War and he made all the soldiers sick. But instead of paying for the rights to Adagio for Strings, they had very similar music that was doing the same things that Samuel Barber's piece does. Okay, so what does the piece actually do then? It stays consistently tonal from beginning to end. Basically starting out on a minor one chord, in this case, B flat minor. And I guess those with synesthesia would argue it has to be, with the exception of possibly E flat minor, one of the saddest keys to play in. Mostly because strings are all tuned to open notes like, you know, C, G, D, A, and E, all considered very bright. So in order to play this piece, there are no open strings at all. They all have to stop it. So automatically that gives strings a dark color. They can't use the open strings because then they'll be playing, or in this case, you know, with a minor third. But the piece, taking a step back and look at the large overview, the piece itself doesn't really represent any technical challenges for the players. The biggest difficulty here is not that it's a fast piece, you know, hence the name Adagio. It's a very slow piece, so any flaws that will be exposed, you know, in probably twice the length. I had mentioned the fact that it's in B flat minor, so there's no open strings. The players really have to know their positions, and some of the thornier harmonic areas, usually just regular minor triads with different passing tones. The player has to really use their ear to stay in tune as a result, because B flat minor is an unusual key, and we'll have, you know, flatter sixths and flatter minor thirds than one's used to in a equal tempered way. But that's what makes string players, when they're playing only strings, a lot more expressive. They're playing in between the notes that we usually use on the white and black keys on the piano. The same effect you'll hear if you hear an a cappella group that sounds a lot more expressive in terms of being able to bend the notes a little bit so they can really wring the most out of them. That's an added thing that comes with this piece in terms of its expressivity. And it's a very expressive piece, but basically it's an arch form. Starts out on a minor one chord and ends on the five chord, which in basic music theory means you want to return back to the one chord. It's A section. Actually, I think I was racing through that a little bit more andante than adagio, but that's the opening sequence that establishes the one chord of the piece. In the famous B section where they just, you know, hold a cluster very high and then there's silence. Thank you. And then the ending of the piece. And that's where it ends, but it implies a return to the beginning. Like that, and that's what forms the circle. Actually, the reason why he ends in that five chord is because it actually propels itself into the third movement of string quartet. But taken by itself, it implies a sort of eternal loop of this piece, or an eternal loop of pain, unending sorrow. Nothing is resolved in a narrative way. Literally, it becomes a spiraling pool of sadness, a vortex into which all listeners are drawn in. But of course, this effect isn't made apparent unless one, you know, actually listens to it from beginning to end. And this is not the case when it's often used in visual media. And it's interesting that there's a lot of 20th century composers, and I think a lot of people know the case of Ligeti and his use of his music in 2001. They don't like their music being used. They feel like it's denigrating somehow. But since Kubrick's use of some pretty far-out music in 2001, and in The Shining especially, and now we're seeing in Shutter Island with Scorsese, who's pulling in a lot of the same kinds of music that Kubrick was using since The Shining, that a lot of composers are finding that their 20th century masterpieces are finding their rightful place in Hollywood as soundtracks to psychological thrillers. A lot of that has to do, of course, with the all the intervals that are being used. A lot of minor seconds. A lot of major sevenths. Automatic tension. But it's interesting that in the piece, and it's pointed out, putting the instruments being played at the extreme ranges of their tessitura. Tessitura being a vocal term of where the piece lies in your voice. So in this particular case, you're having the strings play very high up in their range, and it's also written for the lower strings to play in the very low part of their range. When you have people playing in this range, very high and very low at the same time, it leaves a tremendous gap in the middle, which, according to the sonic spectrum, is the place where the human voices lie and where other sound effects in general, you know, would take place. So when you're mixing this all together, you're having music that has a complete open hole for dialogue to be dropped in. So Hollywood composers have to write according to this. Here we have a piece of very serious music that already is just ready to go. Since it's not competing with the voices in the dialogue, you don't have to mix it down. You can actually make it as loud as the voice because it's not competing with the same octave that the voices are in. And it just raises to me the question of whether or not this was also an added element that made it particularly useful in synchronization with Hollywood films and other kinds of soundtracks where dialogue was used on top of the music. Also something that a lot of composers really don't care for, especially Mr. Ligeti in 2001. It seems that the Mr. Barber himself, or whether it was his estate, I don't know, were very liberal in letting his music be used, probably because of the tremendous boost it gave to him in his career since his earliest use in 1938. It was broadcast on the air when Toscanini premiered it. So right away, it already had an association with broadcast media. And then FDR dying in 45 or 44. I'll have to look at the back of my dime to find out. And maybe this has something to do with him being an American, that he was very happy to have this plug into all the various, any outlet where music, you know, his music could be heard. He knew would not be a bad thing. It was not denigrating, and it would make the a percentage of the listeners actually want to hear more of his music, you know, in the venues that it was intended for.